Good morning. Well, I have to make an announcement at a certain point this morning, I'm going to turn the pulpit over to Dave Comstock. And at that point, I'm also going to grab my stuff and go out the door so I can get home down the gorge. I consulted with no fewer than two scientists who spend time either in the air or observing the air. And juggling their two opinions, I've decided I'm going to go. I don't mean to risk or harm myself, so I will. I'm not going to push it to the bitter end. I'll stop somewhere along the way and sleep if I need to. So just to let you know, I have no intention of sacrificing my body to the cause. But many ancient traditions tell us how the whole world came into being when an enormous cosmic person sacrificed his or her body. It was cut to pieces and distributed. Norse legends tell us of the frost giant Ymir, murdered by his rivals but then given new life by the gods as they used parts of him to create the soil, the mountains, the moon, and the stars. India's Rig Veda, one of the oldest scriptures in the world, has a different take. Here, there's no murder, but the cosmic giant willingly offers himself as source material for so much more to come. He's called Purusha, which sounds like person and means the same. 1,000 heads has Purusha, 1,000 eyes, 1,000 feet. On every side pervading earth, he fills a space 10 fingers wide. This Purusha is all that yet has been and all that is to be. Well, the hymn now continues with the sudden appearance of some unnamed gods from offstage who prepare to sacrifice this great person using the earth itself as the altar. Big guy, big altar. When gods prepared the sacrifice with Purusha as their offering, its oil was spring, the holy gift was autumn, summer was the wood. They consecrated as the sacrifice on the grass Purusha, born in earliest time. From that great general sacrifice, the dripping fat was gathered up. He formed the creatures of the air, the animals, both wild and tame. From that great general sacrifice, scriptures like this one with its hymns, spells, and charms were produced. So if we were part of this religious system, this very order of service that we're following was once part of that great cosmic sacrifice. Also, from it were horses born, from it all cattle with two rows of teeth. From it the goats and sheep, presumably the mice too. When they divided Purusha, how many portions did they make? What do they call his mouth, his arms? What do they call his thighs and feet? The moon was gendered from his mind, and from his eye the sun had birth. Fire was born from his mouth and wind from his breath. Forth from his navel came midair. The sky was fashioned from his head. Earth from his feet, from his ear, the four directions. Thus they formed the worlds. Seven layers of fuel were prepared. When the gods, offering sacrifice, bound as their victim Purusha. Gods sacrificing, sacrificed the sacrifice. These were the earliest rituals. You should be relieved to know that we will be having a very different kind of religious service today. Or will we? See what you think after we sing. For the earth forever turning. Hymn number 163. Number 163. We'll look forward to the return of that blue and green. Well, did the reading that I did sound to you like something from a religion class? But to tell the truth, it was something that we read in our class here on Eastern Religions a few years back. Boston University religion professor Paula Fredrickson often asks her students, what are the major differences between ancient and modern religions? They begin to spin out differences in beliefs, ideas, and values. Most of them believed in many gods, whereas we believe in one or none. They thought that diseases were caused by demons and disasters by the stars. We know more today about microorganisms and earthquakes and the like. These answers have their virtues, says Professor Fredrickson. But I do not think that the biggest difference lies in the realm of religious ideas. Ancient Jews were monotheists, but also fretted about planets and demons. For that matter, certain pagan philosophies had their own forms of monotheism. What has changed, altered utterly, is religious behavior. Worship in antiquity involved blood sacrifices. Universally, the worship of a deity, virtually any deity, involved the slaughter of animals and the ritual redistribution of their bodies. Some parts burned on the altar to the divinity, some parts eaten by the priests, other parts distributed to the worshippers. So animals, she tells us, chosen for sacrifice were often remarkable specimens. Perhaps they had a special color, a white bull, a red cow, something like green eggs and ham. And Sam, you have to remember, was honoring that fellow who wouldn't take the green eggs and ham. He just didn't get that at first, that to be offered is to be honored. Anyway, maybe that animal had to be born or hatched or captured at a certain time of year in some special place or in some special way. And you've probably heard that some people even practiced human sacrifice. Sometimes these could be prisoners of war or slaves, but they often came from honored families and spent their lives being treated like living divinities themselves before the sacrifice sent them home to heaven. The point here is that a powerful sacrifice is not usually chosen from among surpluses, be they surplus objects, animals, goods, or people. Remember Purusha. He was not only enormous with his 1,000 eyes and 1,000 feet, he was also the only person in the universe, unless you count those unnamed gods who sacrificed him on the altar of earth. The question is whether anything like this persists among us today, even in a sort of minimalist religious setting like this one. How could that be so, when we don't even have an altar to speak of? Are we utterly cut off now from the religious ways of the ancient world? Well, Pamela and I have been married now for over 30 years. Sometimes we pause to consider how we've managed to do it, speaking cautiously so as not to draw too much attention from demons or stars that might put a jinx on our good fortune if we seem to be bragging. It took us years to put a finger on one of the things that we do hold deeply in common. We both have fathers who came out of an immigrant Catholic background. Poor Irish for her, poor Italian for me, though both of us were raised Presbyterian. In fact, Carol King, is she here today? Carol King and I used to go to the same Presbyterian church in Illinois. But having a large extended family nearby meant that I had to attend many, many Catholic weddings, communions, wakes, and funerals. There were always cousins or second cousins getting married, great uncles or aunts or third cousins' brothers dying. No matter how often I went, the services still seemed strange to me. I was at sea while my cousins all knew how to cross themselves and when and what to do with that kneeler thing in front of the pew. You know what I'm talking about? Sometimes it's padded, sometimes it's not. But what seemed strangest to a kid who'd been dragged to Protestant church for several years was the communion. Now, there's often a scaled-down version of communion in Protestant churches. Even in the old Universalist church where I first served, they kept a little communion set in a locked cabinet. Like every minister for the past 100 years, when I first arrived, I was shown where to find the key. There was a bit of controversy during my tenure when some UU Christians in the congregation wanted to use this set after their Bible study group, but it cleared up in time. Unitarian churches in Hungary and Romania still have communion 4 times a year, when, you should know, attendance always triples. But it's all small potatoes when compared to Catholic communion, which occupies so much time in church services, much, much more time if the congregation is big. It also occupies more space. The altar table is placed front and center and is much larger than the pulpit. When you include the movement of the people from pew to altar and back again, a huge portion of the floor space is also involved. The Vatican encourages priests to keep sermons to 8 minutes or less. So, why shouldn't the pulpit be smallish and off to the side? By contrast, the pulpit in a Protestant setting is usually front and center, made with more and richer materials than the altar. If there is one, there is an altar. This makes sense. Sermons in 61% of mainline Protestant churches run from 11 to 20 minutes. In 27% of mainline Protestant churches, they run from 21 to 30 minutes. Mine used to be near the top end of this scale, but now they're near the bottom. Only 1% of mainline churches have 30 to 60 minute sermons, whereas they run that long in a full 27% of conservative Protestant services. I think stretching the name Jesus into a 3 or 4 syllable word that probably accounts for some of this time. There should be a contest. How many syllables can you get in there and make it sound good? I don't know if you can get past 4. But anyway, you've probably also heard about how in colonial America, sermons could go on for hours. A monitor would roam the aisles carrying a long rod with a feather at one end and a brass ball at the other, so he could reach the middle of a pew, tickle your nose if you'd fallen asleep, or bonk you on the head if the tickle didn't work. This is true. I've considered keeping a pop gun or a pea shooter up here to use on our sleepers or our knitters. You wonder why Meryl went to Olympia? She heard about the pea shooter. Next, it might be tamari ball makers, as you're working on those beautiful things here in the during the service. Actually, I don't mind. How can people drift away into dreams, though, or into their own thoughts when there's someone up front bearing their soul? Nudity always gets my attention. And isn't this just another form of it? I'm just teasing. But isn't the pulpit a way of sharing both body and soul? Why not just sit together and read a sermon, or maybe an interesting article on religion or social issues? Wouldn't it be the same? Hardly. Remember that Catholic communion is understood as a way of sharing the actual body and blood of Christ in order to nourish the body and soul of his church. One God became one man one time only, then gave up his body to redeem the world. It's not so very different from old Purusha giving up his own body for the creation of heavens and the earth and everything within them. Even in word-centered religious services, the pulpit does double duty as an altar of sorts. The minister of the word offers him or herself there, often risking a great deal, and sometimes losing it all on a single Sunday morning at this altar pulpit. We've all heard of that happening. And some of us might have actually witnessed it as well. Maybe a minister has come out as gay, or in support of LGBT people, or of civil rights, as a prophetic witness to a host of other inconvenient truths or causes. And that has proven to be a bit too much. The poor minister may have thought that this was part of his or her job description. Now, philosopher Paul Ricoeur speaks of bearing prophetic witness as a kind of necessary treason. Necessary treason. It's treacherous to commit what he calls aggression against the security of man. Older language. When people there in the pews have enough problems to contend with already. This means that when I hear someone talking about me or someone like me, I want to be pleased and soothed. If I'm challenged, I want it to be not much and not for long. This is as true of ministers as it is of anyone else. But we forget sometimes, or else jump in and take a chance, only to learn that the altar never really goes away. It just shifts shape and position. Where has it gotten to today? Where is our altar? Do we even have one? Is there any point, any place, where the dripping fat has been gathered up like it was from Purusha's sacrifice or in the old temple of Jerusalem, maybe? How about right here, right now, burning in the flaming chalice, the symbol of our religious movement? What is it that keeps this flame burning? Any ideas? Time, talent, treasure, our offerings. I participated recently in an online discussion with all the UU ministers in the Pacific Northwest, US and Canada. Someone lit the flame by asking if it wasn't about time to replace the practice of passing bowls and baskets for the offering. Why not install a card swipe machine at the back of the sanctuary so people could make their donation on their way out to the parking lot? Well, this got me to thinking. It's not only the pulpit that does double duty today. So do the pews or chairs. If you've ever explored the Old Testament, you may remember its descriptions of burnt offerings and whole offerings. If you've been living a real life in this real world of ours, you know that there are days such words apply to you. Sometimes you come in here feeling burnt by life, by work, by the way things are going for our world and our country. Other days, you feel deliciously whole, an abundance of life and love that you're happy to share. On any given Sunday, these chairs are filled with the burnt and the whole. Offerings on an altar that fills this whole dang sacred space. How appropriate that we pass a sacred vessel through every pair of hands to make the offering explicit. The vessel up front holds the flame, while these moving vessels collect the oil to keep it burning. Of course, we use money, which is nothing if not pure potential. Pure potential. More than any oil. More pure than any oil. Funny stuff. The bowls of pebbles that we shift while sharing our joys and concerns represent another kind of offering. Do we give when we take a pebble from the small bowl and receive when we put it in the larger one? See, the other way around? Isn't every offering a matter of both giving and receiving? I shared some of these thoughts with my colleagues online. Most affirm their support for continuing with offering practices, much the same as ours, much the same as in most churches. But no one spoke disrespectfully about the idea of maybe using credit cards instead on your way out the door. Questions like that can provoke us to think. They can help us to remember that the great practices of religion do not really go away. They're as persistent as Sam I am. always ready to shift position, take a new shape, try it a little different way. Today, the offering basket helps to sustain a weekly connection, a living bridge between altar, pulpit, pew, and you. Another form this connection takes is our stewardship campaign. It's a yearly form, and this is that time of year. We hoped it would be springtime. We know that what most of us give, most of us here give, we do not give out of a huge reservoir of surplus time or treasure. Though I do suspect there's quite a lot of surplus talent here, just waiting to come forward. But for now, will Dave Comstock come forward to explain this year's plan? Thanks, David. And thanks for your understanding as I leave you now to get home before the worst of the storm in the gorge.
Blessed be.